If you need a new roof or a repair, Easton Roofing will take care of you. Estimates are always free and suggestions are built on integrity. Visit EastonRoofing.com for more information. Get back to business faster with Easton Roofing. Easton Roofing. Integrity matters.
Gerritsen and Toth presents The Shift with Jack Johnson on ESPN Kansas City, 1510 AM and 94.5 FM.
We are back with another edition of The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I am your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. Shout out to our presenting sponsors, starting with Gerritsen and Toth. They handle the most complex felony, federal, or state criminal defense cases. You'll find they've been doing that successfully, helping criminal defendants all over the Kansas City area and Northeast Kansas for years. Also, a shout out to Active Family Chiropractic. If you're dealing with any neck, back, shoulder, or any type of pain, go in today and schedule an appointment. Their office is located on 135th and Antioch in Overland Park, Kansas. Or just give them a call at 913-681-6013. That's 913-681-6013. Stop dealing with those nagging pains that keep you up at night and call Active Family Chiropractic today. Today just feels like a really good day to spend the majority of the show on your young and for the most part improved Kansas City Royals. This might be the most excited I've been to talk about the Royals since opening day. I was there last night at the game. The Royals had a fantastic lineup in, by the way. And they beat the White Sox 6-2 behind another solid Zach Greinke start. They'll go for a series win later on this afternoon, first pitch at 1:10. But let's start with last night. And I don't think it's too shocking to say that we all noticed something different with the offense last night. With the plate appearances, with the pitch recognition, against a very good pitcher at that, Lucas Giolito. Though he's coming off the COVID list, you know, he probably wasn't going to be stretched out into 100 or 105 pitches, but he still threw 92-5. So the Royals made Lucas Giolito, who has usually dominated the Royals, whether that be at guaranteed rate or at Kauffman Stadium, they made Lucas Giolito throw 92 pitches in 5 innings. Now, he only allowed 2 earned runs, but there's a reason the Royals were able to eventually pull away. It's because they got into that White Sox bullpen early. But you even go back to the second inning. That's where I wanted to start with this conversation. They give up a run in the top of the second with 2 outs and a runner at third. Larry Garcia pokes one into left field. He seems to always be the new Royal killer. He's been doing it since 2018. Not the best hitter in that lineup, probably one of the worst hitters in that lineup, but doesn't matter. Every time he faces the Royals, he seems to pull through. But the Royals come to bat in the bottom of the second, and you kind of feel like we're headed for a similar route. In the bottom of the first, the Royals load the bases with 2 outs, but MJ Melendez goes down swinging on a filthy changeup, by the way. He worked the count to 3-2, and I know most of us want to pile on the Royals for not scoring with the bases loaded in the bottom of the first list, and it was 2 outs, nobody on. They load the bases with 2 walks, a Bobby Witt Jr. single at 108 miles an hour, and then MJ goes to the plate. He's down in the count 0-2, and then works it back into a full count. Now, the changeup that Lucas Giolito threw, I mean, 8 out of 10 hitters are going to swing at that. I mean, that barely missed off the bottom right of the zone, and MJ was kind of in protect mode there, but he went down swinging. So in the bottom of the second, you feel like that might have been your best chance to score off Lucas Giolito today. As overreacting as it may sound, Lucas Giolito does not give up many runs at Kauffman Stadium. So when you do have those opportunities, it's about capitalizing on those opportunities. But in the bottom of the second, once again, the Royals have 2 outs and nobody on. Nicky Lopez battles against Lucas Giolito and singles the right field. Then, just like the old school Royals, he swipes second base. Whit Merrifield works the count, and he ropes a single into center to tie the game at 1. Feeling pretty good. That's a that is back-to-back great plate appearances against a very good pitcher. And that's when I started to know that this offense looked different, as early as the second inning. Because all the way through the first time through the order, the Royals were having good at-bats. Not one player had a poor at-bat. Now, some resulted in a strikeout, but they were making Giolito throw a lot of pitches. And by the end of the second, he was nearing 60. So you knew unless he cruised through the next three, he wasn't going to be able to go into the sixth. One inning later, and now both games I've covered at Kauffman Stadium, a guy by the name of Bobby Witt Jr. has absolutely demolished a home run into damn near the fountains in left center field. But he gets an 0-1, I believe either a hanging changeup or a hanging curve from Giolito, and he just pounded it. He tanked it into left center about 20 feet short of the fountains. I think if it would have gone about, 50 yards further, it would have landed behind the wall in center field. The batter's eye, that is. I mean, that's how hard and that's how far Bobby Witt Jr. hit the ball. And we can see him slowly and slowly start to turn it on. That power is starting to show. And he's hitting the ball incredibly hard. And that's always a sign for a hitter that is figuring things out. Not to say that he was completely lost, but you could see the early season struggles. Now, not all of that was his fault. Because when you have nobody else hitting in the lineup, it's tough to be that one producer. And Bobby Witt Jr. now, I mean, you think about where he was, hitting in the low 100s, way back in early April. Bobby Witt Jr. Now has a slash line. It's not pretty. It's not the best, but in 134 ABs, he is slashing, if MLB will load here, he is slashing this season, 224, 268, 403. Not great, right? We don't feel like that's a very good slash line. But in large part, it's due to what we've seen or what we saw at the beginning of April. But Buster only tweeted this out about 3 hours ago. And that's Bobby Witt Jr. is slowly starting to turn it on. And though we don't always notice it, he is somebody out there that is putting a barrel on the ball. The exit velo is showing. That power is showing. And in his last 23 games, Bobby Witt Jr. is slashing 256, 302, 467 with 12 runs, 5 doubles, 1 triple, and 4 homers. You'll take that every single day, especially for a guy that's only 134 at-bats into his rookie season. Look around the league right now. A lot of the top prospects, they're not playing super well. Spencer Torkelson, who might have had a hotter start than Bobby Witt Jr., he's now struggling mightily with Detroit. But Bobby, once again, his first two at-bats, exit velo over 106. Hard hit single and blasted a home run. Now, Zach Greinke, he had another Zach Greinke start. 5 2/3, 7 hits, 2 earned runs, 1 walk, 4 strikeouts. That one walk is kind of the outlier because he doesn't walk anybody. But he does give up a run in the top of the fifth, but battles back, strikes out back-to-back hitters, works a little bit into the sixth, but then they bring in Colin Snyder, who gets out of a bases-loaded jam. So Zach Greinke, who got 17 outs in the game, he still doesn't qualify for the win. In 7 of his 8 starts this year, Zach Greinke, he has allowed 3 runs or less. 7 of those 8, 3 runs or less. He is 0-2. He does not have a win. The Royals don't give him any run support. But I don't think Zach cares about it. And Zach mentioned that in the postgame. He said he stopped caring about wins in 2005. He said he knew he was pitching well, but the wins weren't racking up because guess what? The Royals sucked back then. So Zach just said, well, it doesn't matter anymore. Records don't matter. As long as I'm pitching well, I'm putting my team in a chance to win. I feel good about it. Then in the bottom of the sixth, a very entertaining inning. MJ Melendez, who had struck out in his first two plate appearances, he rips an opposite field single, which, by the way, we don't talk enough about how good MJ Melendez is at going the other way. And he's still a very young hitter. But MJ is a guy that, with his swing, it allows him to go the other way. And he kind of is looking to go the other way. And though they're still shifting on him, which, I mean, I guess you go back to the minor league numbers, he was more of a pole hitter. But that's something a young hitter is not supposed to be doing this early in his career. I have seen multiple hits the other way by MJ Melendez. And when he does pull the ball, he hits it hard over the shift. Still a small sample size, but I have no complaints with how MJ Melendez has played since coming up in Kansas City. So he rips an opposite field single, and the Royals have one runner on with one out. 2-2 in the bottom of the sixth. Then Emmanuel Rivera, who, once again, we have not talked enough about. He is going to be a platoon hitter for this team. He's not going to be an everyday player. I don't think his defense is good enough in that lineup, and really he can only hit four-seam fastballs, which he's hitting about 605, I think, or 655 on four-seamers this year. And on a 99-mile-an-hour fastball down and in, he rips it to right field. Adam Engel dives and misses it. So it goes all the way to the wall. He slips, by the way, and everybody in the ballpark is thinking, Emmanuel Rivera is about to get an inside-the-park home run and take the lead. Now, MJ scores with ease, but Vance Wilson at third base, he knew that, oh, I'm not gambling again. And Emmanuel Rivera is way slower than Hunter Dozier. He wasn't going to score. But in the heat of the moment, I think most third base coaches would have tried to send Emmanuel Rivera. But maybe it's a good thing that yesterday, or 2 days ago, when he sent Hunter Dozier and he got canned by 20 feet, he's not going to make that gamble anymore. And Emmanuel Rivera probably would have been thrown out by the same length. But it's easy to get caught up in the moment of, man, that's a long throw for Leury Garcia, but he made it yesterday. So they hold him at third, and then Kyle Isbell comes up, and something the Royals have not been able to do all year, get the runner home from third with one out, he does just that. Fly ball into shallow to deep center field. I know it doesn't really make much sense. Medium deep center field, we'll go with that. And Emmanuel Rivera scores. So it's 4-2, bullpen does its job, Staumont good, Taylor Clark good, and then here comes MJ Melendez in the bottom of the eighth, runner at third, one out. All you need is a fly ball. He does more than that. He absolutely obliterates an opposite field home run to left center field. 428 feet, 105.4 miles an hour off the bat. So of the young guns yesterday, the Royals ended up winning 6-2. Colin Snyder got the win. Bullpen was scoreless. That's Snyder, Staumont, Clark, and Barlow. They get a two-hit game, a multi-hit game from Bobby Witt Jr., who also had an RBI. They get a multi-hit game from MJ Melendez, two RBIs. They get a multi-hit game from Emmanuel Rivera, and they get a multi-hit game from Kyle Isbell. They're all in the lineup once again today as the Royals go for a series win against the Chicago White Sox. Now, we do have some audio and some good ones, I think, at that. We'll start with Mike Matheny, who in the postgame usually is going to be upbeat. Not too upbeat, but more upbeat, obviously, after a loss. It's not really a shock that most managers want to talk about the game when they do win. But there was more of an emphasis on these young guys. And here's what Royals manager Mike Matheny had to say in the postgame win against the Chicago White Sox.
Yeah, just really, obviously the two home runs, another really nice at-bat with MJ, but you also had Rivera, really good job defensively today, big hit, triple, Isbell, great job getting the sack flag and another couple base hits and playing good defense. Guys play good defense this whole game. But we've talked about, you know, what do you got to do to get the offense going? You need those two out hits. That's what Witt did, and then we got to just drive the ball and get the opportunities, and a couple of young guys provide a lot of excitement. It's fun to watch them.
All of Bobby's home runs this year have been over 400 feet. It seems like the ball has a louder sound and carries longer off his bat. Is that something you've seen as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all know we weren't seeing a whole lot of balls just weren't going anywhere early, and now they're starting to warm up. Kind of expected that. It's just got that extra little life carry for him. But, you know, he hits the ball hard. That's what he's always done all through the minor league system, even as an amateur. That's the thing that always stood out, is consistently being able to have hard contact. And it's going to turn into good things. He's in a real good place now. Not trying to get big, but nice short. You know, he's got enough power when he's just short of the ball.
Are you noticing with MJ just getting more comfort level just all around?
Yeah, what else you could ask him to do. I mean, that pickoff snap throw to first, and that's when you start to see just kind of that athleticism and that naturalness. I know we talk a lot about he just does some things really all day long. Blocked about a dozen balls. Just had a real nice rhythm. I'm sure Zach might say something, but Zach came in and said, you know what, he called a really good game. And I don't know if MJ realizes what a compliment that is, because that guy's not easy to please. He's thinking, and you better be thinking along with him. And for a young player, the first time he catches a veteran pitcher like that, and for them to be on the same page, that's probably as impressive as anything that happened today.
Zach, in general, just seemed like another one of his out injuries, just mixing everything. But what did you see?
Yeah, I see that we got to get him a win, because he's done good enough to have a bunch of them. He's a joy to watch. That's pitching at his finest, and how he just manipulates and makes minor adjustments. He's figuring out ways to get the kind of break he wants on a slider, and then he'll toy with his changeup a little bit. Just the stuff that he can do midstream, just you wouldn't want to try to teach anybody else. But he's very unique, and he's doing such a great job of making big pitches in big situations.
Like, after you guys get the lead in the sixth, you give Stallmont the heart of the meat of the lineup. How about the job he did for you there?
Yeah, fantastic. You know, that seventh's been hard for us, especially when we got the heart of that order coming up. And Josh and Scott both, they've had a lot of work, but they know how important each game is. And if we had an opportunity, they're both ready to go. And Josh came in and did a fantastic job. And then Taylor Clark, too, after coming off one that he wanted to forget in Colorado, to be able to get back in there and pitch a really good eighth for us, where we could hand it off clean to Scott in the ninth. And they're all starting to kind of figure out how to feed off each other.
You mentioned the two-out hits. Those at-bats from Nicky and Witt, how important was that at that point in the game so we get you guys going?
Yeah, it's interesting as you just look at how hard it's been for us to pull off those two-out hits, especially when we have been in scoring position shooting. It's been hard to pull off less than two. Just getting big hits, and Witt's always had a knack for it, and it's just a nice, simple approach. You got to change up, stay towards the middle of the field, and next thing you know, it puts us on the board. It's the right approach. And you know, they fought today too, right? You saw a lot of foul balls. You watched the elevated pitch count, kind of stuff that's happened to us in the past, but that to me is the kind of offense that we can be. Even Santana, watched him today, fouling off balls, working walk. It's that relentless grinding at bat that I think turns into big innings.
I was going to ask about your approach against Giolito.
That was Mike Matheny yesterday in the post-game press conference after the Royals beat the White Sox 6-2. Now, this one I think was the most interesting interview of the night, and it involves MJ Melendez, because MJ had a phenomenal game, 2-for-4 with a home run, 2 RBIs, great at-bats in all four of them, really. I didn't think there was one bad one. You could say his second at-bat when he struck out on 3 pitches, but was kind of an expanded zone. The first 2 called strikes were not close, and then it forced him to swing at 1 out of the zone. But the last 2 were great, going the other way and then going the other way again, but hitting it 430 feet and damn near into the fountains in left center field. But he said the most excited he was in the game was not his home run. He said what was better than that was Zach Greinke telling him after the game that he called a great game. He enjoyed it so much, and we hear this in the audio, that MJ texted his dad afterwards. And that's where you kind of realize that these are still young guys catching for guys they grew up watching. I mean, Zach Greinke's 38 years old. MJ Melendez is 23. So when MJ was, let's see here, 5, Zach Greinke made his major league debut. 5 or 6, I think, around that ballpark. And now he's catching for him. But here's what MJ Melendez had to say yesterday in his post-game interview following the Royals and White Sox game.
To get another home run, how did that feel? It felt really good. I mean, going into that at-bat, had a pretty good plan. Felt really confident, and, you know, it was even better when Santana was able to move the guy over. I knew all I had to do was really just get it past the infield, you know, try to stay off the ground, but anything to the outfield, I was feeling pretty confident that I was able to get that run in.
What was it like catching Greinke tonight?
Oh, it was awesome. That's something that is can be crossed off the bucket list now.
You know, he's going to be a future Hall of Famer for sure. So it was an amazing experience. And, you know, just really seeing the way that the wheels turn in his head, you can almost see it. And, you know, just trying to get on the same page with him each and every pitch so we could work quick and efficiently.
What's that dynamic like with a veteran pitcher like him? And you try to think along with him? Do you let him kind of do it?
So I knew at first it was going to be I was like, all right, you know, he's probably going to shake a little bit. He knows what he's going to do. He's seen plenty of hitters throughout his time in the big league. So, you know, kind of just try to follow along with what he wants and try to catch on to that and see how he likes to set up the hitters. And that was something that I was trying to do. And it felt like, you know, throughout the game was getting better and better at doing that. And, you know, trying to get him to shake off as least many times as possible by me just thinking along with him.
He mentioned that you called a few that he probably wouldn't have called, but he went with it, and it worked out. I mean, is that a nice compliment for you?
that's one of the best compliments I can get, definitely. you know, he's got great stuff, and, you know, when he goes in there and he throws stuff with confidence, I don't think anybody can hit it. So, you know, it was really, really cool.
Was that the times when you were sort of like, you know, veering off of scouting report, was that more so just trying to think along with him, or was that reading something with swings, or what was most of that?
No, so it was still going along with the scouting report, but it was also something that, you know, I know, you know, just based off of kind of watching him the past couple weeks, and, you know, in the past, you know, what his pitches are, and I know he likes to throw his changeup a lot, and it's a really good pitch. So in certain situations, maybe using that to get a strikeout, even when it was a pitch where maybe he was thinking slider, and that's maybe where he went with my suggestion.
Do you feel like you're getting more settled in or just confident behind the plate? I mean, I'm thinking about the snap throw. I mean, it seems like a sign of you settling in a little bit.
Definitely. I think, you know, just the guys have been really good. The pitchers have been really good with me. They've worked for me. Bearing with me, too. You know, the first couple ones were rough, but I feel like I'm starting to kind of get more comfortable and starting to, you know, get more confident in my game and my game calling and my game play. So, and it's all just goes back to before the game planning with the coaches.
I think it's easier knowing that, I mean, at least a week or so, like, every day, you're doing kind of the same routine. There's not the guessing game of whether or not you might get a lineup or behind the plate.
I mean, either way, I think, you know, just going into the day, just being prepared to do whatever it is I need to do to help the team win. And, you know, even though he's hurt, but he's still helping me. You know, behind the scenes, he's doing a lot. I know without him, it would be very tough. So him being here still makes it just that much easier. And, you know, I'm going to continue to talk to him every day and get advice.
Matheny had said, after he made it sound like Zach said something about what a good game you called. Did he say anything to you coming off?
Definitely, yeah. We talked, and he complimented me. So that was something that I told my dad. I showed him. I was like, man, it's probably made my day. This is better than the home run almost.
I mean, obviously you guys did a lot last year, but you and Bobby home run in the same game, doing it up here after, you know, all the times early on last year. It's just sort of like that experience, like.
Yeah, it's a great feeling. I mean, being able to do it last year was a pretty awesome feeling. And, you know, this year in the big leagues at the biggest stage, it's really, really cool. So looking forward to doing that a couple more times this year, hopefully.
To see Emmanuel Rivera do what he's done at the plate, I mean, you see him probably more than most of, at least me. I mean, how impressive has he been just watching through the minor leagues and even up here?
Very impressive. I mean, his start in AAA says it all this year. He did an amazing job. He's probably seeing beach balls at the plate. So for him to do that, and then even.
That was MJ Melendez yesterday in the postgame interview after the Royals 6-2 win over the Chicago White Sox. They're back in action this afternoon as they go for a series win in this weird 5-game series with Chicago. It'll be Carlos Hernandez on the bump today against Vince Velasquez. Velasquez is 2-3 with a 5.53 ERA. Hernandez will go for his first win of the year. He is 0-3 with a 9.11 ERA. One thing to look out for, a higher velocity with Carlos Hernandez's fastball. I believe J.J. Piccolo mentioned a couple of days ago that he's getting another start, basically to go see how hard he can throw the ball. Just go out there and throw the blank out of the ball. It's your last chance to stick in this rotation. If you can't do that, can't command it, you get hit around, you're not going to be in the rotation next time around. But Royals lineup today, it'll be Whit Merrifield leading off in right field, Andrew Benintendi batting second, playing left. Bobby Witt Jr. will hit third and play shortstop. Hunter Dozier will hit cleanup and play first base. MJ Melendez will DH and hit fifth. Emmanuel Vera will bat sixth and hit play third base. Kyle Isbell will bat seventh and play center field. Recently recalled Sebastian Rivero will hit eighth and do the catching. And rounding it out, playing second base and hitting ninth will be Nicky Lopez. Carlos Hernandez once again on the bump. Royals will go for a series win and look to move to 5-3 against the White Sox this year and 10-8 against the American League Central in 2022. When we come back here on The Shift, wasn't planning on doing this, but we have to get into the comments that Jimbo Fisher had about Nick Saban this morning. We'll get into all of that when we come back here. You're listening to The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. Welcome back into The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. It's been a while since we've talked some college football, but there's no way in hell I was going to pass this up today. The comments that Texas A&M head coach Jimbo Fisher had about his former, not coach, because he was an assistant under Saban's staff, about Nick Saban. The comments he had about Nick Saban. And here's some background information before we give you this quick 3.5 minute clip of what Jimbo Fisher said. And by the way, after you hear this clip, keep in mind for the next 2 weeks, or I think in 2 weeks, Saban and Jimbo Fisher and the rest of the SEC coaches have to be in a tiny room together for those conference meetings. So we'll see just exactly what goes down there. But Texas A&M has, I believe, the number one recruiting class in the SEC this year. Number one. Alabama's number two. And Nick Saban has voiced that he does not like the NIL deals. And he doesn't like the idea that you can now buy players. And Jimbo Fisher went off. He ranted because Nick Saban accused A&M of buying all their players they got in this recruiting class. Saban legitimately said that A&M bought every single person on this team. I mean, it's shocking. This is from Brett McMurphy, who's America's College Football Insider with Action Network. He said this 12 hours ago. He tweeted this out, that is. And it was on the NIL deal. Actually, this is via Mike Rodak, who's Alabama's beat reporter from 4all.com. I believe it's Alabama's local newspaper. I guess that's my best guess. So Saban said this last night. We were second in recruiting last year. A&M was first. A&M bought every player on their team, made a deal for name, image, and likeness. We didn't buy one player. By the way, SEC spring meetings are less than 2 weeks away. So here's what Jimbo Fisher had to say in response about Saban's comments, who he coached with a couple of years back.
Last night in Alabama?
Yes, I would. First of all, I'll say it's a shame that we have to do this. It's really despicable. It's despicable that somebody can say things about somebody and an organization. More importantly, 17-year-old kids. You're taking shots at 17-year-old kids and their families. That they broke state laws. That they're all money. We bought every player on this group. We never bought anybody. No rules were broken. Nothing was done wrong. It was all in the way we do things, the ethics in which we do things. And these families, it's despicable that a reputable head coach could come out and say this when he doesn't get his way. Or things don't go his way. The narcissist in him doesn't allow those things to happen, and it's ridiculous. But when he's not on top, and the parody in college football he's been talking about, go talk to coaches who coach for him. You'll find out all the parody. Go dig into wherever he's been. You can find out anything. And it's a shame that you got to sit here and defend 17-year-old kids and families and Texas A&M because we do things right. We're always going to do things right, but we're always going to be here. We're doing a heck of a job. These coaches have done a great job. Our players have done a great job. The whole organization of recruiting people. It's despicable that we got to sit at this level of ball and say these things to defend the people of this organization, the kids, 17-year-old kids, and their families. It's amazing. Some people think they're God. Go dig into how God did his deal. You may find out about a guy that a lot of things you don't want to know. We built him up to be the czar of football. Go dig into his past or anybody that's ever coached with him. You can find out anything you want to find out, what he does and how he does it. And it's despicable. It really is. And it's a shame we have to sit up here and have this conversation about things we do. And it's personal to us? Yes, it is. It's personal to A&M. It's personal to our players. It's personal to our coaches and everybody involved. And I know the guy. I know him really well. It's amazing that we're allowed to do those things. It's really despicable. And I hate it. For our players who are coming here, who did things the right way, have done things the right way, and will continue to do things the right way, I apologize to you, the people who insult you publicly the way they're doing it. And our fans, I apologize to you guys for people saying those things about Texas A&M. But I promise you this, there are no violations. There are nothing wrong. It's the second time we've had to do this with grown men who don't get their way and want to pout, throw a fit, and act up. Just go ask all the people who work for him. You'll know exactly what he's about. I always said this. My dad always told me this. When people show you who they are, believe them. He's showing you who he is.
Questions? To the left, Olin.
A couple of things, Jimbo. First of all, have you had any contact with Nick since?
No. Oh, he's called.
You just didn't take the call?
Not going to. We're done.
And
he shows you who he is.
And then I just wanted to.
He's the greatest ever, huh?
And then I just wanted
when
to.
You got all the advantages?
Huh?
It's easy.
And I just wanted to just put it point blank. So no players in your. You're saying that no players in
the
state.
There's no bylaws of anything we ever promised, done anything that goes against the laws of the state of Texas, and it's insulting to say a 17-year-old and his family broke laws. No.
Down front, Brent.
You know, y'all have both spoken so highly of each other in the past in terms of what y'all have done in your previous relationship. So how disappointing was it to hear that from him, you know, in terms of, you know, a mentor type to you?
It's disappointing.
Well.
No, I wasn't. No, listen, you coach with people like Bobby Bowden and learn how to do things. You coach with other people and learn how not to do things. There's a reason people don't go.
That was Jimbo Fisher's rant earlier this morning after the comments Nick Saban made about Texas A&M last night. So not holding back in the slightest. And that is probably as open as any coach has been about another coach in a long, long time. Now, I want to say that in the Power 5 era, when you look at Power 5 programs, are we really to believe that going back to, hell, 90s, 80s, as far back as you want to go, that everybody's crystal clear, they're all clean, nothing dirty on their hands, right? It's happened in college sports for decades that paying of players happens. It happened before it was legal. Now it is legal. You get NIL deals. That's why the transfer portal is so full. It's why top recruits are going to go to programs that can offer the most money. And when you look at Alabama, number one, with Nick Saban saying, we've never paid anybody. Come on now. Come on now. Alabama. Now, listen, if you got that program, you have that culture, you have that tradition, you're always on CBS primetime, you are going to get a lot of TV recognition. And a lot of NFL players, a lot of NFL greats have come out of Alabama. But college kids aren't all for that all the time, especially not now, because it is legal now with NIL to get money. You can get compensated for being a star player at a Power 5 university. But man, you're meaning to tell me that decades ago, even when Saban first started Alabama, to the height of Alabama, they're still kind of in the height, they're in the peak of Alabama football, competing for national championships. They never paid one of those players when it wasn't legal. And now Jimbo Fisher. You know, I get his anger, his frustration, saying that not one of those guys they paid. I mean, in reality, this is what every college coach is going to say. I mean, even I'm not going to speculate, but I'm wearing a Kansas shirt, right? They're under investigation. And Bill Self's never going to come out and say, oh, well, yeah, we did pay those players. You know, there was money given to players when it wasn't legal. No coach is ever going to admit to it. That's just the reality of it. When you are investigated, when you're under fire for it, you're not going to admit to it unless you are caught point blank. And with Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban going back and forth, number one, I don't know why Saban is really taking shots at A&M, and good for Jimbo Fisher not picking up the phone. Now, the one thing I may disagree with is that I think we look at it in a way now that it's just like it's so appalling. Like with Saban saying Jimbo Fisher paid players to come to A&M. Is he the first one to do it? If he did, he denied it. But again, we won't know because we probably won't ever know unless there was some actual hard evidence that A&M paid players to get the number one recruiting class. Alabama had number two. You got to think somewhere along the lines money was paid. Now, I can only speculate. I'm just a fan of college football. I can only see the product on the field. And Alabama is always going to get top recruits. That's the way it will always be, even when Saban's gone. And until Alabama tails off again, which it may never happen, Saban's coaching tree is that good. They could just continue to filter in great coaches. The culture stays. Alabama's going to be a top five team every single year, if not top two. As for A&M, I mean, I can see why Saban's a little bit accusatory because A&M is not Alabama. A&M is not Georgia. A&M defected from the Big 12. They've had a couple of good years, but for the most part, not really consistent. Can hang around 7-5, 6-6, 8-4, 9-3. They bounce around. And then they get the number one recruiting class. If you're Alabama, you're probably a little bit ticked off because if you're Alabama, if you're Nick Saban, you always want to be the best at everything. Not only winning national championships, you want to have the best recruiting class. I'm sure everybody goes out and tries to get the best recruiting class. It doesn't always happen. Vanderbilt's never going to have the best recruiting class in the SEC. You know, teams like, I mean, Tennessee from time to time maybe could because of the brand, the program name. Arkansas has had very good recruiting classes. Florida because of the brand and the name. But you look at the bottom of the conference, South Carolina, you know, Vanderbilt. You go up and down the SEC. Ole Miss, Mississippi State. They're not going to get the same type of recruits that Alabama gets. Now, when A&M got it and they surpassed Alabama's recruiting class, Saban's going to take it personally. But this is why we watch college sports. It's why we watch sports in general. You want to see stuff like this happen. As much as you say, oh, it's maybe bad for the sport, you never want to see former colleagues go at it. No, now isn't everybody going to tune into the A&M-Alabama game in Tuscaloosa this year? A&M won last year, by the way, in College Station. I guarantee you that fueled a little bit of the comments of what Saban was saying last night. He doesn't want to lose to Jimbo Fisher. And man, now that Jimbo Fisher has fired at Alabama, I can only imagine what that crowd's going to be like. Because every fan base out there, every successful program, you're prideful. You want to believe that you do things the right way, right? That everything you've done is clean, is perfect. And every school that's not as successful but looks at the other schools, they want to always point the finger and say, well, you're good because you cheat. And that's the one thing I will say about Jimbo Fisher's comments. He says, well, it's easy when you have all the advantages. I mean, are we just going to sit here and say that Nick Saban's not a good coach without talent? I mean, you can have your opinion. I think Saban's still a really good coach. I mean, even with all that talent, you got to win with it. You got to win multiple championships, which he's done. Like, that's the one thing that I've never sort of agreed with. That programs, yeah, you can't really be this prideful program and be successful and know the landscape of college sports and say, oh, we've done everything the right way. We have never cheated once. Because in college sports, it's happened everywhere. There's a great movie about it, Blue Chips. It shows that when people's jobs are on the line, they'll do whatever it takes to win. And you never really can point the finger if you don't know exactly what's going on in your program. And so for Jimbo Fisher saying that, oh, we've never paid anybody. Well, as long as nothing comes out, these allegations against Saban, they can hold. But again, if nothing comes out about Nick Saban's past, which he said to go in and dig through his past and see what you find, the only thing that has a lot of weight in it, which probably looks bad on Alabama, is Jimbo Fisher coached with Nick Saban. And he's talking about, go look into his past. Go look into former coaches. Oh, you'll see what goes on. Therefore, Jimbo Fisher has some knowledge about what goes on in recruiting trips. How they get players to Alabama. How they get players to wherever Saban's coached. How they got players to LSU. I mean, that's the type of thing that I look at and say, okay, I could believe Jimbo Fisher here. Now, if Jimbo Fisher was just this other coach in the conference that looked at it and said, okay, hey, I don't like Nick Saban. We have a rivalry. I'm going to now accuse him of cheating. I mean, the closest thing we've gotten to another coach accusing another coach of cheating was Bruce Weber in the Big 12 tournament accusing Bill Self of cheating and Kansas of cheating. Remember that when they lost to, who was it, West Virginia, Big 12 tournament? He said, yeah. I grew out my hair because I was waiting to cut it until a team in this conference got punished, basically. Yep. It looks bad.
Some of his final words as head
Some
coach.
Of his final words and got canned the next day. So those are the type of things that you kind of look at and you scoff at. Now, that's a rivalry, and I think that Bruce Weber and Bill Self have never truly gotten along. But you look at Jimbo Fisher and Nick Saban, I think for the most part they had respect for each other. I think Saban wants to see his former coaches do well, but that bridge is burned. That is completely burned because Jimbo Fisher just completely put Nick Saban on blast this morning. And you said Nick Saban tried to call him, and he declined all the calls and said, no, we're done. He showed you who he is. We're done there. Our friendship, our relationship, it's done. Cannot wait for college football, by the way. And that's wearing a Kansas t-shirt. I can't wait for college football. Number one, and I'll throw it in there, I think Kansas will be much better. But you get storylines like this. SEC football is great, and they always have the best storylines. The Big 12 doesn't, the Big 10 doesn't, the ACC doesn't. It's the SEC because you know the SEC controls college football. We will take a one-minute break. When we come back, we'll give you a little NBA recap and preview heading in to the weekend and finish up with some fact or fiction. You're listening to The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. We are going to wrap up the show today. We got about 6 minutes left, so we'll get some NBA preview for you, some NBA recap of what's already happened. Both sides of the conferences have already played their game one so far. The Miami Heat won Game 1 in South Beach on Tuesday, 118-107. Jimmy Butler was the leading scorer in that game with 41 points, 9 boards and 5 assists and 4 steals. Completely stuffed the box score on Tuesday night. As for the Boston Celtics, Jason Tatum led the team in scoring with 29 points on 10 of 21 shooting. Jaylen Brown led the team in rebounds with 10. Jason Tatum also led the team in assists with 6 and 4 steals, but did have 7 turnovers. They will have Game 2 later on tonight, 7:30 on ESPN. It'll be Game 2 in South Beach. Miami is a 3.5-point favorite. The over-under is at 206.5. As for the Western Conference Finals, last night, if you tuned in, the Warriors completely routed the Dallas Mavericks. An ugly Game 1 for the Mavs. An ugly Game 1 for pretty much everybody on the Mavs. With the exception of Spencer Dinwiddie, I guess. Luka Doncic did lead the team in scoring with 20 points, but shot 6 of 18 from the field. He also had 7 boards and 4 assists. As for the Warriors, a very, very well-balanced scoring effort. Steph Curry led the team in scoring with 21 on 7 of 16 shooting, only 3 of 9 from deep, though. Andrew Wiggins, the former Jayhawk, 19 points, 8 of 17 shooting. He was plus 28. In the plus-minus category, Klay Thompson had 15 points on 7 of 13 shooting. Draymond Green had 10 points on 4 of 6 shooting, plus 25 in the plus-minus column. And Kevin Looney, a perfect 5 of 5 from the field, had 10 points, 5 boards, and 4 assists. Off the bench, Jordan Poole had 19, and Otto Porter Jr., who is from St. Louis, by the way. I think he's actually might be from a certain area in St. Louis. I can't remember. He went to a very prominent high school in the St. Louis area. I can't remember, but I always remember Otto Porter being a big name coming out of high school. Surprised Missouri didn't get him. I thought I remember there being a storyline with that.
Yeah, Missouri didn't even recruit him. So, but we live and we learn. Jason Tatum, too, another St. Louis kid. Might have heard of him.
Yeah, just a little bit. But the Warriors win Game 1, 112-87. Also, for some reason, it was such a big storyline yesterday. Did you see Luka drinking beer at like 11:30?
Yeah, have himself a cold one.
Who cares? People were literally trying to bag on Luka Doncic for drinking a beer with Boban Marjanovic. Just outside, it looked like a, I don't know, a little patio area.
When you're famous, man, everything just turns into a
clearly.
Headline,
I mean,
guess.
What can a 240-pound man, is he going to get drunk off one beer, or is he going to be out of shape for game one? And I guarantee you everybody's going to use that for the way he played poorly in game one, that he drank a beer during the postseason. I mean,
after knocking off the Suns in seven, okay?
Yeah. Hell, I wouldn't care if he would have partied all the way up until game one. I mean, we remember Dennis Rodman taking flights to Vegas in between.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Lakers at the Forum had the club underneath the arena. It's fine.
It happens, and it's one beer. It looked like a light beer as well, but I have no problem. I think Luka will be able to force this into at least six games in the Western Conference Finals. As for tonight, if you are into watching the NBA, Game 2, we already mentioned that, sorry, on Friday, that's what I wanted to get to.
Yeah.
Friday, Game 2 will be in the Bay Area. Warriors and Mavs will tip off at 8 p.m. on TNT. Warriors are a 6.5-point favorite, over-under at 214.5. So we're getting into the final couple games before we have our NBA Finals representatives from both the East and the West. Now it is time for some Fact or Fiction. 5 questions, 5 takes under 5 minutes. Marco, fire away.
Jack, Fact or Fiction, Carlos Hernandez throws at least 10 pitches 98 miles per hour faster today.
I think he's going to air it out. 10 might be a little bit too high. I'm going to probably put it around the 7 or the 8 range, so I'll say fiction on that.
Fact or Fiction, Deron Blanco gets his first major league hit this homestand.
So that was the roster move. It was kind of leaked last night, but Deron Blanco, the guy acquired for Jake Diekman and I believe Kevin Merrill back in 2019. But Blanco, speedster, and he will probably get at least one or two chances to play this week because the Royals still play Minnesota after Chicago. I'll go fact on this. I think that he does get one hit on the homestand, his first major league hit, that is.
Fact or Fiction, the Royals take the series today.
It has a weird feeling that they will, but they've lost every single day game I've been running the board and they're on the TV, so I'm going to go fiction. Because Carlos
Except
Hernandez
for the home
the
opener.
Family. That's true.
Fact or Fiction, A&M beats Alabama this year.
Oh, boy. I know A&M's going to be really good, but Alabama's not losing back-to-back years to A&M, so I will go fiction on that. I think Alabama will win. And I don't know the line yet, but I'll say they'll cover.
Fact or Fiction, Steph Curry wins Finals MVP.
So you know that I have the Warriors winning the NBA Finals. I think now I still think it's going to be Boston in six, unless Miami wins tonight. Then I'm going to have to change up my prediction, though I don't want to backpedal on that. But I will say that, yes, if the Warriors win it all, I got Steph Curry winning the Finals MVP. There is Ray Charles, so it is time to go. That wraps up another edition of The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I've been your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. We'll be back tomorrow, a Friday at 10 a.m. You take it easy, Kansas City.